Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Tinsberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I have as a guest Sam Lipsight, and boy, do I go up and down the flagpole with him. I find it some of the funniest stuff, and then it starts offending me, then I get angry at him, then I realize it is funny and that my anger is part of the joke. So, first of all, this book of short stories, The Fun Parts, how far back do they go? What's the time range of these stories?
Well, Most of them were written in the last 3 or 4 years, and a few go a little further back than that. While I was writing my last few novels, I was writing some short stories as well and playing around with shorter pieces. And then after The Ask, while I was writing my last novel, The Ask, I had this sense that I'd really like to dedicate more time to short stories and short fiction, see what it was like for me. Now, my first book had been a collection of short stories, and
it was Venus Overdrive.
Venus Drive, yeah.
Yes.
And I just wanted to see what it would be like for me now.
To go back to the short story. Yeah. And what is it like for you now?
Well, now that I've done it, I'm not sure. But at the time, I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. But what were you thinking? Well, I'm going to take this to the top. I'm going to revise the form. What were you wanting?
Well, just, I think that a lot of the stories in the first book had dealt with some of the same characters. It was kind of a partially linked collection. This time I was more interested in an eclectic collection. There are some overlaps here and there. But I wanted to take a number of different approaches and not have the book be sort of thematically the same, but be something where each story was its own kind of try.
Yeah. Now, I want listeners to hear right away where we are. You're going to hear a passage. Some of it is going to get your goat. It's going to start a flame war. The writing is here to say this is where we live now. And I think it has to. Not every writer can do this, can take us into these back streets, back alleys, and the contemporary language, the freedom of assault, seems to me to be beautiful. This is Sam Lipsight reading his story, Nate's Pain is Now. Could you begin by telling about the title?
Well, this narrator here has a protege named Nate, and he feels that his moment is slipping and that Nate's pain is right now. Nobody wanted my woe. Nobody craved my disease. The smack, the crack, the punch-outs and lockdowns, all those gun-to-my-temple whimpers about my dead mother and scabby cat, nobody cared anymore. The world had worthier victims. Slavers pimped out war orphans in hovels hung with rat-chewed velveteen. Babies starved on the desert floor. Once my gigs at the big box bookshops teemed with the angry and ex-decadent, the loading bay anarchists and hackers on parole, the meth mules, psych majors. Goth girls, coke ghosted, rehabbed at 12 and stripping sober, begged for my sagas of degradation, epiphany. They pressed in with their inks, their dyes, their labial metals, and scarified Montes, cheered their favorite passages, the famous ones, where I ate some sadistic dealer's turd on a Portuguese sweet roll for the promise of a bindle, or broke into a funeral parlor and slit a corpse open for the formaldehyde. My fans would stomp and holler for my sorrows, my sins, sway in stony reverence as I mapped my steps back to sanity, the stint on a garbage truck, the first clean screw, or whatever semblance of sanity was possible in a world gone berserk with misery, plague, affinity marketing. I had what some guy at a New Paltz book cafe called ARC. You can't teach ARC, he told me. Nobody's born with it either. I stood for something. My finger lingered on the somehow still flickering pulse. I had a good run. Bang the Dope slowly, and its follow-up, I Shoot Horse, Don't I? Sold big. I bought a loft, married Diana, the lovely Diana, who'd stood by in the darkness, my research years. My old man, the feckless jerk, even he broke down and vowed his love. But as a lady at a coffee bar in Phoenix put it, what goes up can't stay up indefinitely because what's under it, supporting it, anyway. There are wise women in Arizona. It was here in New York City that I first noticed signs of my decline. Standing at the lectern under those harsh chain store kleegs, regaling the crowd with the particulars of a scam I used to run on Alzheimer's patients from a clinic near my squat, I heard a voice spear down from the balcony. Enough already. Excuse me, I said. I said enough, said the man. He leaned past the rail, a fattish fellow with lovely corn-blonde hair. So you almost died and hurt a lot of people along the way. You got your medal. Go home. It was true about the medal. I'd recently won an award for creative nonfiction from a major credit card company. Maybe some others here want me to finish, I said, hearing my voice strain now against some sissified collapse. Freaking sheep, said the man. Leave him be, called a voice. It sounded like Nate, my protege. He'd been a homeless gay punk. Now he was my homeless gay punk protege. Other voices rose to join him. My minions were protecting me. How humiliating. I felt like that bullied boy I described in Spoon for the Misbegotten, the one who ran home to weep and quaff his mother's cooking sherry, not that my mother ever cooked, let alone with sherry. Yeah, back off, he's been through a lot. He's fragile. He's a fraud, called the man, who I saw now wore heavy coveralls, splotched darkly in places with what could have been berry juice or blood. He's our friend, somebody said. Thanks, I said, but I can take care of myself. There were murmurs now, mutters, maybe. We've got your back. We're here for you, and we... somebody trailed off. Don't you get it, said the man in coveralls. This guy betrayed his friends and family. He's contributed untold thousands to the drug economy, which has probably helped get others hooked, and now he blabs about it for cash. And don't start in about his philosophy. It's half-baked nonsense. He teaches us nothing. You really need this guy to tell you capitalism poisons our bodies and corrupts our souls? Are you that dim you can't figure it out for yourselves? Nobody spoke. I was sensing a strange mood in the crowd tonight, a balkiness I had never encountered. They were maybe beginning to be done with me. I think you're the dim one, I said. Weak meat, boomed my butcher.
Sam Lipsyte, reading from the story, Nate's Pain Is Now, from his collection, The Fun Parts. Okay. Sam, what could be more imaginatively vile than someone telling us about a scam he used to run on Alzheimer's patients from a clinic, better still, near my squat? I mean, that's one in which the sentence itself tops itself in its vileness two or three times.
Yeah, it does have an ascending effect there. Well, you have to remember this character, this speaker, is somebody who makes his living by confessing the most degrading details about his life. And he's also someone who doesn't write one drug memoir, but writes several and has to kind of keep relapsing and getting into troubled waters again so he can rise out with a new book. And so he's always willing to tell you the worst about him. But I think that's probably true of a lot of the speakers in my book.
Yeah, typifies them in a certain way. And those who are a little bit less vile seem to be learning from the more vile, as if this is a cultural phenomenon encouraging us to open our yaps and yawp, you know, just roar with our pain. Now, this is satire. It's pretty clear. You don't think that everyone should start writing their addiction memoir or their love addict memoir But what is a response to these stories? When you write them, how do you imagine people hearing them?
Well, I'm glad you used the word hearing, because for me it starts with the language, the way the narrators talk, just the way the language is forming on the page. That to me is the spark that gets everything going. So I'm not coming in with an idea or even a judgment about what people should be doing or writing or saying, but I'm find myself drawn to characters who are going to talk a lot, because that gives me a lot of room to do things in the work.
Mouthy first person.
Yeah.
Now, how much does misery act as the springboard for this kind of story writing?
Yeah, there's some kind of there's some sense of being ill at ease, I guess, that fuels some of this. And I'm just, I guess that's what draws me to characters who feel a little bit at the wrong angle to the culture or the world.
Remind us, because this was something that American humor was doing in the late 60s, early 70s, but it is hard to take, or am I wrong?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know what it was like then for people, but certainly then people were more willing to read and write work that embraced some really painful parts of being a human being and tried to find both the tragedy and the humor in it. I guess, you know, there's a phrase that used to be used a lot, seriocomic, that, you know, mm-hmm. doesn't get used that much anymore. But now there's kind of a problem some people sometimes have with understanding that things can be dead serious and funny and brazen and strange, and also trying to be very human and have deep empathy at the same time.
Now, I noticed that in this collection, The Fun Parts, what a title. I didn't know until the last story that The Fun Parts is a kind of slang for the genitals.
Yes. I thought. Nor did I.
You mean you invented that?
No. I didn't know that was going to be the title, that's all I mean.
Now, the first three stories are milder. They're more nuanced. They stay within the realm of the merely miserable rather than the hyperkinetic miserable. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that these three stories appeared in The New Yorker. Tell me, what is a writer like you doing in The New Yorker?
Well,
I don't mean that as an insult. I mean it as a compliment.
No, I understand. I mean, I was delighted that The New Yorker started taking stories from me. I'd sent them a lot of stuff over the years and assumed that was a kind of place that would never publish my work. And they didn't change anything, but I think I wrote those stories. And I think two of them have female protagonists, and that was something new for me. And maybe that has something to do with a different kind of approach that I used. But they started to see work that they could connect to, those the editors, and it's never The New Yorker, it's a few editors, and so I was thrilled about that. I think that I wouldn't call them milder, but I would say that their approach to storytelling is perhaps the frame itself is more recognizable.
Now, when writing that previously wouldn't have been in The New Yorker appears, does that mean there's a new generation, both of writers and of sensibility?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to think so, that some shift has happened. I've sort of seen this in my writing life as well, as things have gotten better for me as people who were younger and were working either in books in some way or critics, as they start to, and I don't mean just for me, but as they start to mature and be in positions where they can publish their criticism or choose which books to publish and all of that, then their tastes become a little more dominant. And so I think you're always seeing these kinds of shifts every number of years.
Oh, absolutely. I think there is a new generation too. And I think it's a new generation that has come to birth having watched The Simpsons, for a good part of their life, having seen The Big Lebowski, that there is a sense of what the comedy of ordinary life is about now that might not be so pretty. We might not have been comfortable before.
It's absolutely those things, and also that things for a while now haven't been that pretty. And, you know, people have been living for some years now with a lot of uncertainty and a lot of, you know, financial hardship, and things shifted in a big way.
Now, these characters your characters, tend to become hilariously potty-mouthed. Is that part of the new sensibility, or are you bringing that to the party?
Well, I've always been a big potty mouth. And actually, I went to my high school reunion, and a woman came up to me and said, "I read your book. You're a potty mouth." And, and then stormed away. So,
well, I got to say, you broke me down this time. Because maybe the book began with three stories that had been in The New Yorker, I found that bit by bit, as the stories increased in mayhem, extremity of language, bizarre vileness of imagination, I thought, I'm getting a kick out of this. I'm starting to like it. I guess the way you could like a comedian like Don Rickles, as he got more and more red-faced and more outrageous. Are your conscripts the people who say, "Oh yeah, you do go where I always wanted to go," you know, in the way of insulting the culture, getting angry, getting at the foibles? I mean, it seems to me that you become the Pied Piper of a meaningful counter effort.
I mean, I don't think of it on those grand terms, because you can't and just do your work. But I feel that I've always been a writer who responded to the world, who wanted to write things that would last, but also were responsive to the times and to the mood and things to what I felt, both, you know, internally and also about the world at large and the problems besetting it. Not to make any moral claims about it, but just to sort of describe a feeling that I think maybe a lot of people share, which is a number of things that we've been lied to a lot, and even the language that we use is sort of often in an official capacity, a euphemistic language that's about covering up other darker realities. And then we're sort of put in this position where we have to kind of measure ourselves against these unrealistic ideals in the culture about what we should look like and what we should be doing and what kind of careers we should be having and what kind of families we should live in. And all of these things, I think, lead to anger because, you know, that's all well and good if the basic things are being delivered, but maybe in the last few years they haven't been delivered so well. And now people are really starting to look at everything, at the kind of whole edifice, and wondering, you know, what's this made of, and why have I let myself hate myself because I don't, you know, quite belong here.
Wow. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Sam Lipsight about his book, The Fun Parts. We'll continue after this short break.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry, you can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Sam Lipsight about his new book of stories, The Fun Parts. These stories go from the funny to the painful and the wild, and as you go through the book, the con men begin to proliferate. So there's a James Fry-like or Augustine Burroughs-like figure. There's someone who's trying to make money off the Mayan apocalypse, they're people inviting us to join in a certain kind of rapacious glee at the end of the world. Do you feel that glee?
No, I don't. I have a family. I'm one of those people worrying about when is that coming exactly, and what's it going to mean? How is life going to change? Do I have the proper footwear? All of those things.
Do you have what is the proper footwear?
Well, my theory was always that I should wear a sturdy pair of boots at all times in case it hit the fan and it was time to go on the run. But then I realized I would probably be killed very quickly for my boots, and so it could be a disadvantage to be well shod.
Well, you need to distress those boots so that they don't look sturdy.
Exactly.
Yes. I mean, that question, as I was reading, entered my mind. How do I meet the wrath to come?
Right, yeah.
And if it's possible to, do I need a mouth like yours?
Yeah, no, I don't think any mouth is going to help when we get there. But I think in the meantime, we can make as much poetry, as it were, as we can. And,
yes.
And because we still have that.
Yes. Well, then will you answer one of those piteous and ridiculous questions of mine? What becomes of beauty? You talk about making poetry out of it, and I think, yes, dark, horrible poetry.
Sure.
But what about beauty?
Oh, I'm not against beauty. I mean, I find a lot of beauty in these characters and their sentences. I mean, not that I'm not going to stand in judgment that way as though I am in a position to say that about my book. I try for that. I am attempting that. And beauty in their ability, often in this book, that people still find a way to strive and still find a way to keep on, fail better. And,
yes.
And to me, there's great beauty in that, and great beauty in, Charan, the philosopher, said, every book is a postponed suicide. And that sounds incredibly grim, but I don't consider that grim at all. I think that we're doing all of these things to not surrender and not allow ourselves to be crushed by everything that's trying to crush us.
I'm not someone who's known for his sunny disposition, and yet I'm very grateful to you for mentioning, do you say Chiron? His name is spelled C-I-O-R-A-N-E-M.
I've heard it. That's how I've heard it pronounced,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
And he is a philosopher of decay. In fact, he wrote a short history of decay.
He did, yeah.
And of the sense that we are, yes, in what Christians call the end times, but you don't have to be Christian to perceive that the clock is ticking. And for him, that is what philosophy has become, a study of the ways of the culture, of the civilization, as it enters its countdown. Is that, to what extent should fiction be that as well?
Well, I'm never someone who says fiction should be one thing, and I delight in all sorts of fiction, but I think that perhaps my work sometimes engages those kinds of themes, but I don't think that's what fiction should be doing. Overall, that it's just kind of the way I swing.
I got it.
Yeah.
This is when it gets scary. Does that indicate, do you write with great anxiety?
Well, I think some kind of energy and anxiety. I mean, the energy of anxiety, I think, fuels in some way what I'm doing. But it's not the kind of anxiety that undoes me or makes me incapable. It actually... It's a useful anxiety, and also a kind of anger that's born of resentment at feeling the anxiety in the first place. And I think you get into a swirl, and you are wondering why does it have to be this way, and you know you turn on the news and you think why are they making that decision? Why are they doing that? And they said they weren't going to do that, and now they're going to do that. And we see that all the time. And then, you know, we're also, again, measuring our lives against things we don't really know the truth about. And so there's just a lot of things mixed up in there.
When I was reading the fun parts early on, there's a woman who wants to be a mother, mm-hmm. and who feels that... Well, she doesn't want any particular kind, sex, gender, color, baby. She would just like it to be with its spine on the inside.
Right.
And I find that heartbreaking.
Yeah.
That someone, given the history of chemicals and our medications, should have to worry about that.
Yeah.
Now, that's not your heartbreak as a writer. That's our heartbreak as a people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's your job to put that on display?
Well, it's only my job as long as people want to read that.
Uh-huh. Oh, it's only your job if you're employed.
If I'm employed. Otherwise, I would just do it as a hobby. But but I, you know, a line like that, to me, can be both very funny and very poignant, and speak to, again, some of the types of fear that we live in all the time. And so, yeah, that's part of it too. And part of that, you know, for this woman, her maternal drive, it's not, I have to have the perfect baby. It's, I just want one that's, you know,
with
intact,
all the parts.
With all the parts.
I've been talking with Sam Lipsight, author most recently of The Fun Parts, a collection of short stories published by Farrah, Straus, and Giroux. Thank you, Sam, for joining me.
Oh, thank you.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Fun Parts at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Robert Dewhurst. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm, when Mohsen Hamid is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.